Welcome to Big Game Hunger, a show where me and a guest craft the big next game every episode. We'll be taking three random ingredients and blending them together into one incredible game. I'm Jenna Stieber, and I crave content, and I'm joined by Jacob Geller. Jacob, who are you, and what do you have a hunger for?
Hello, I'm Jacob Geller. I am a video essayist, I suppose. I'm a writer who makes my writing, and I like saying I'm a writer in, like, polite company. And then they're like, what do you write? And then I'm like, I do YouTube. But I think of myself mostly as a writer who then does video on the side. And I hunger for the day that I can close Adobe Premiere and keep it closed for more than a week, because it's been open constantly for like the past 2 weeks on my desktop, and I am done with that program.
Because you're working on something?
Yeah, I'm.
Or
doing,
you just find it comforting?
No, I don't find it comforting at all. I'm making a video that will be out by the time this episode comes out. That's close to an hour long, and
goodness,
it's not that hard to write an hour long video, then editing it takes twice as long as a 30 minute video. Who would have guessed?
Exponentially. I would say four times as long, because it is you get a certain point in Premiere Pro where it can't deal with the amount of stuff that you have ingested, and like it all slows down. I think twice as long as being too shy.
Yeah, and also I'm constantly experiencing the thing of like I do like video editing. I find it kind of a fun creative process, but I am getting to the point where it's like, I've been doing it for long enough that I've kind of decided on fun stylistic things that I was not doing at the beginning of the editing process. And so then it's like, okay, well now I've got to go back and like make sure that it's all consistent by adding the fun stuff that I started doing at the end to the beginning. And so then you're kind of re-editing everything. Look, I would just like to be playing games and reading books and writing things again. And instead, I've been looking at editing timelines for like two straight weeks.
I respect that work ethic, but I would also remind you that you're your own boss. So like you could, you have a flexibility. You could just chill for a week.
Yes, I am my own boss, and I'm maybe not the type of boss that I would like other employees to have. kill the boss in your head. It's like I have a schedule, and I like being on that schedule, and it's like after I'm done with this, everything else is just this kind of like research can be kind of a fun nebulous data gathering, like go in whatever direction your heart desires process. And editing is really the only one where it just feels like you're building a brick wall, and it's just like you gotta keep putting bricks there until it is done, and it kind of doesn't get done any other way.
That's really interesting, because I find that it's almost inverted, where it's like script writing is really a process of lie and bricks, where it's just like you just kind of gotta get down on your knees and start piling up. But editing is always so, it goes so quickly for me. I really just love it. I could sit and edit for 12 hours straight and not realize that I've spent all that time doing it.
And the process of like losing time is kind of fun. And I do get that concept where it's like, where I look up and it's like, it's been 2 hours and I haven't even like taken a drink of water.
Well, that's not ideal. What games would you be playing if you were not working on this video edit?
I have got into Dragon's Dogma 2 to some extent. At the time of recording, it is not out yet. And that is challenging, because this is a game that I would be reading a lot of like top 10 tips you need to know to get into Dragon's Dogma 2. Because like it's a big game, and a lot of its systems are not super clearly explained while you're playing it, which is great, but like I don't know how to use half the scrolls in my inventory right now, and I just need like the Polygon article that's like, here's how to use the scrolls in your inventory in Dragon's Dogma 2.
Yeah, that's always the tricky thing about getting games in embargo, because there's part of it that is thrilling, because it's like, oh, the newest, freshest game not yet out on the market, and you're getting to explore everything for the first time without any preconceived notions or expectations or things like that. And that's something I really enjoy about that. But there is the flip side, where if you get like stuck, you're just stuck. Like if you're running into like a pathing issue and you're not certain where to go next with your character, you can't just Google like a walkthrough or something. So
yeah.
It's a double-edged sword.
I've written to publishers or like PR twice asking, what do I do next? And both times I have found the solution immediately after sending the email. And then I kind of like sent another one that was like, my bad. It was right in front of me. I didn't find it.
Do you normally play like big RPGs like Dragon Dogma? Did you play Dragon Dogma 1?
No, I didn't. And since it came out, I have been hearing basically all the people who I respect in the gaming world just like talk about how cool Dragon's Dogma 1 is for that whole time. You know, it's like it's a big Austin Walker game where it's like he has for years been bringing up Dragon's Dogma 1 and the experiences in that. And I feel like, you know, Cameron Kunzelman also really liked it. It's like a lot of people who I really like their taste and I really like how they talk about games talk about Dragon's Dogma 1 being this like really interesting kind of different take on how you can make one of these RPGs. And so I really want to be into Dragon's Dogma 2, and already I can see a lot of the stuff that they like that people have talked about being cool about the first one is in here. But it's like it's a really high commitment game. You know, it's like nothing in it is easy, and that's kind of the point. But it's like when you have to walk from one town to another, it's like you better be ready because the walks are really long and they're very dangerous. And if you like die on the walk, then you're going to have to like go back to the first town and lose a bunch of money.
So it's like unoptimized, but in a purposeful sort of standpoint where it's like that's part of the game.
Yes, I would describe it as like, if you remove every quality of life feature, you actually get something really interesting because it's like you have to do everything yourself and the game doesn't kind of like streamline any of it. And that's cool. But it's like I need that subreddit or something for people being like, hey, did you know that you can do this? And it like really helps out with things.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I love the idea of a game that's built towards the vast community knowledge that ends up building up around these games. I feel like Elden Ring, to a certain extent, maybe to a large extent, was built knowing that there would be a huge community of people playing it and leaving messages and sort of giving you those sorts of insider intel.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious if Dragon's Dogma 2 is going to be the same way.
I think it will. I mean, the first one has a pretty committed audience. I mean, the other thing that is interesting with like Elden Ring is like, I think you really need, I'm a big proponent. People talk about, go into like this From Software game blind, you know, like don't read anything about it and do it. And I think that's terrible advice. And I think whatever your first From Software game is, you should like read tons of walkthroughs, do lots of tip sheets, whatever, because you basically need to learn how it works. And then your second one, you can go in blind because you have like, you know, you built the groundwork for yourself. Yeah. And so my guess is if I had played Dragon's Dogma 1, I would be like so
set
in
up,
and know exactly what to do and like know what the fun differences were. But like, I don't have that foundation yet. And I kind of need to like build that for myself.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's true. If you've never played a FromSoft game before and you want to get into it, I highly recommend just like finding other players, ask around your gamer friends, get on the subreddit, get on an email group. Do those still exist? Find an AOL chat room where other FromSoft players are at. Because like I feel like the community lore of how to like build a game is going to be so much more useful to you than just reading a tip sheet. Although reading tip sheets also super, super useful.
I am constantly shocked by how helpful it is to literally just watch someone else play a game. You know, because it's like you can see, you know, you can see things that they're doing that you're not doing. But you also just like it's just taken a step back and you have more time to like notice all of the things that when you're in the game itself, you're maybe like too frantic to notice or whatever, especially in like
FromSoft
big
games.
Boss game. It's like you need just like to be able to watch that boss without the threat of getting your head chopped off. And it's really hard to do that when you're the one playing the game.
That's true. It's so easy to die so quickly for a lot of bosses that watching a run through of even if somebody's not beating it, but watching somebody else fight is a great way to pick up those clues, those attack clues and those movements and things. Mm-hmm. You ready to go to the ingredient list? where we pick three ingredients of adjective, premise, and gameplay type. Excellent. Good. Good. So I'm going to roll my 3d20. Okay. And I'm going to ask you if you want to participate in the Grant Howitt Dagger Dartboard, where we substitute one of the three options we have gotten with one of Grant Howitt's fucking insane prompts that he gave.
I mean, I feel like it's a coin flip, right?
So it is a coin flip, so it could not happen.
I opt into the coin flip.
Excellent. Okay. This is the thing, is like, I don't want to force it on people if they're like...
It's really hard to say no, though. It's like, oh, there's the dartboard. You want to do it? It's right there.
You can always say no on this show. I might say, fuck you, but you can say no. All right. Heads or tails?
Heads.
Oh, we got tails, so we're not getting it.
It's an interesting, you know, you could do if you lose, then you have to do the dartboard, given how challenging they apparently are. But I'm happy just doing our normal D20s here.
I hear your critique. I reject it. Thank you for submitting it, though. I think I actually think the lineup we have is going to be pretty insane anyway. So our adjective came from actually just... the last episode with Jacob Burgess, it is sloppy. So cool. That's going to be a fun one to interpret. The premise comes from our Patreon subscriber. Thank you, Longtone. They say the Ides of March for the premise. And the type of gameplay, and I think this is going to be a fun one, it's fortune telling.
Fortune telling.
Yes. So the Ides of March, I'm assuming, got submitted because it is when we are recording this March, but also because how much Tumblr loves the Ides of March. I don't know if you're on Tumblr much, Jacob.
I was in 2012, but I haven't I haven't been back in a decade.
Well, the Ides of March, I don't know if that was a thing in 2012 because I wasn't on Tumblr then, but they the Tumblr loves the Ides of March. They love a stabbed Caesar. It's just like a thing.
That and fortune telling feels... All of these feel pretty, like, they're weird, but they all work together pretty well. Because
there's
it's like, fortune
synergy.
Telling is not supposed to be, like, exact, you know? So, like, sloppy fortune telling, not
that's
bad.
That's the connection you were making. Okay, I was thinking, you know, it was probably sloppy, stabbing Caesar a bunch and getting his blood everywhere. That's probably
that true.
Pretty sloppy. But I love the idea that you connected fortune telling and sloppy. I think that's fair. There's, it's an inaccurate science in that it's not a science at all.
Ambiguous more charitably, but sloppy, I think, is... It's funny to picture yourself in this game as, like, a bad fortune teller.
Okay. All right. That is a great premise. Is your main client Julius Caesar? And is he trying to be like, I think maybe... a bunch of people are conspiring against me. And
like,
you can be like,
no, go to the forum. You'll be fine.
No, Caesar, everyone loves you. Everyone loves you, Julius Caesar. That's a really funny premise. I don't know how to expand that out into a game.
I mean, it's so what you I feel like what you could have is maybe what if like everyone involved is going to you? You know, like you are just the popular fortune teller. And so You're getting Caesar, but you are also having Brutus come up, and you're like, I don't know if you're making decisions or if you're just like, you know, are you just kind of like rolling for each of them, or are you kind of trying to like point them in one direction or another?
Well, what if it's, I mean, this is tricky because I was like, what if it is a mystery game and you've got Brutus coming up and being like, man, my friends and I are gathering to do something that's going to really change the politic landscape here and maybe involve a murder. And over a bunch of sessions, you pull this out of Brutus and you're like, I think Brutus is going to stab Julius Caesar. It would be funny. It would be funny if it was a mystery game, but I don't know how to do that for one of the best known assassinations of the world.
How long could you hide... like the setting, you know, like what if you started with like basically no buildup, where you're just in like a fortune teller, you know, tent, but you don't know year, you don't know country, and then you know, like at some point 80% of the way through he's like, by the way, I'm Brutus. And you're like, oh.
Okay, what if we do, so this is a time-honored thing to do in like movies or books, which is to low-key adapt a different story, but with a different setting and different character names. And it's not until the end where you're like, oh, this was just Beowulf. I know this story.
Anyone but you. She's the man.
Yes, yeah, genuinely. No,
they have the same names.
So we could do a video game that is taking part of that beloved tradition. It could even be specifically Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where it is like you're not meeting with Brutus, you're meeting with Bruno. And his friend Jules is being a real dick. Maybe they work in like an office setting, and this is a metaphorical stabbing. Although it'd be funny if it was a modern setting, and it seems like it's going to be a metaphorical, like, backstabbing.
And then they do actually stab him.
It is a literal assassination. Eh?
Yeah, I do really like the idea of, like, essentially the role that a modern-day fortune teller or tarot reader has. And I don't say this dismissively, because I think that people who do tarot or whatever are very cool. But it's, like, it's basically to kind of make some big calls with very incomplete information. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think that's a fun way to go. We're often, I feel like, the way that especially detective stories or whatever work in games is like you find some clues and maybe you can solve it poorly with some of them, and if you keep searching you'll find all the clues, and then you can be very confident in how you're solving the mystery. And I like the idea here that it's like you are not going to get anything more than like one meeting with this one person, and then you have to just like you just gotta make some big fortunes for them.
Okay, I mean we're edging into an interesting territory, and it's one I am very fond of, which is the idea that like fortune telling, when you're telling a fortune, I mean, it's sort of a kind of play, right? Where it's like you're trying to read somebody and their behavior and give them an answer. But I like the idea that we make a game where this is going to be a hard needle to thread. We make a game where you have absolutely no effect on the actual events that are happening because, as is often the case with fortune telling, the things that you're telling them are so ambiguous as to be functionally useless. But oftentimes you take the people who get fortunes, take that information and make choices they think are based on it, but are really just like the things that they were already going to do anyway. Yes, it's the self-fulfilling prophecy itself, a very ancient Greco-Roman concept. So maybe we could make a game. The question is, how do we make that still fulfilling? Because so much of modern games in this vein are like, your choices matter. How do we make a game?
I was going to say, like, that sounds like you're just describing most games that tell me that I'm making important decisions.
That's true. How do we do that in a good job, though? How do we do good at that?
I mean, you could definitely make, and it depends on kind of like the length of what's happening here, because I think you could get some very good comedic beats out of like you telling people things and then seeing them interpret that information in the exact opposite way that you wanted. Like, that would be a funny joke two or three times.
Yeah.
You know, if it was going to be somehow an entire campaign is predicated on that idea, I think it would get a little old.
I'm thinking of like a real short. This is like a 2 to 3 hour game in my mind.
Well, did you play Storyteller last year?
No.
It's a very clever little game that is like very short, but basically it would have a scenario, and it would just tell you like goal is princess poisons queen, and then you would just have characters, and you could be like, okay, queen is rude to prince. Princess loves prince, therefore, you know, and it would kind of make the decision for you where it's like, okay, princess hates queen, princess will poison her or whatever. And so I like the idea of kind of like is setting up all these little things to happen but then somehow maybe the game making that very unsatisfying when they don't listen to the dominoes that you carefully set up.
Did you ever watch X-Files?
Scattered episodes, not the complete series, but I've seen it.
Okay, so there's a really famous episode, and I recently rewatched it because I watch X-Files on network television, and this they just cycle through X-Files basically 24/7. And so there's a very famous episode called Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose, and it's about a fortune teller, a man who can see the future, and another man who keeps killing fortune tellers. And it's the sort of thing where they both the killer and this hero are like clairvoyant in a way. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of know what the other one is doing. It is kind of what you're describing, where it's like it's setting up a bunch of dominoes. The whole episode is a bunch of dominoes being set up. And at the very end, it's one flick and it all kind of falls into place. And it's beautiful. It's one of the best, I think, episodes of a television show ever. It's also hugely, hugely funny. But there is something fascinating to me about this concept of like the ending. We already know the ending, right? And we know the ending of the Ides of March. We know what happens. So how do you make the build up to that happening a fun and engaging game?
I love the idea of, it's like, I don't know how much this has been explored in games, but those stories where it's just like people kind of thinking back and forth, you know, or like thinking through everything, you know, I feel like, you know, a kind of poppy version of this is like Death Note, where it's like the two characters are just kind of like, well, then he knows that I'm going to do that, so I'm going to do this. So he's going to do that.
It's the Princess Bride. It's that Princess Bride scene.
Yes, exactly. There's like a Ted Chiang story called Understand, where it is basically like two people use the limitless pill or some equivalent, where they get like so smart that they are basically like intentionally butterfly affecting, you know, like the world's politics and economy, where they know just by doing this, then like it's going to set off a chain reaction that's going to do a million more things. And at the end, they like fight just by kind of thinking at each other, which is very fun. But it's like, I don't, you know, it's like, I feel like you have to have a really flexible system to make that work in a game, or a really inflexible one. And then you just take the character down one path.
Well, I mean, this game is supposed to be sloppy. So what if it's a hugely imperfect system that's extremely easy to break and has had not nearly sufficient playtesting? I hope you're enjoying Big Game Hunger. You should check out some of the other shows that are part of the Multitude Collective while you're here. Why, I think you'd like Join the Party. Join the Party is an actual play podcast with tangible worlds, genre-pushing storytelling, and collaborators who make each other laugh each week. They're having an incredible time, and it comes through in every single episode. DM Eric and the empathic players Amanda, Brandon, and Julia welcome everyone to the table, from longtime TTRPG players like myself to folks who've never touched a role-playing game before. Are your hands unsullied by dice? You would be welcome here. Hop into the current campaign, which is a pirate story set in the world of plant and bug folk, which is extremely fun. Or marathon the completed stories with the campaign, a Monster of the Week game set in a weird summer camp, campaign, plus campaign 2 for a modern superhero game, and campaign 1 for a high fantasy story. And once a month, they release the After Party, where they answer your questions about the show and how they play the game. Hey, so what are you waiting for? Pull up a chair and join the party. Search for Join the Party in your podcast app or go to jointhepartypod.com. Hey, let me tell you about Tab for a Cause. Tab for a Cause is a browser extension that lets you raise money for charity while doing your thing, the thing you do online all the time, which is opening tabs. With Tab for a Cause, whenever you open a new tab, you'll see a beautiful photo and a small little ad, and part of that ad money goes towards a charity of your choice. As of last year, Tab for a Cause helped people raise $1.5 million for charity, all by leveraging the power of opening a new tab. Tab for a Cause supports charities like the Bail Project and Point of Pride, so whatever charity you feel strongly about, you can have ad money sent directly to them. You can join Team Big Game Hunger by signing up at tabforacause.org/BGH or click the link in the podcast episode description.
I like the idea of actually the Ides of March happening is like the unlikeliest scenario. You know, almost that it's like your fortune telling and okay, another crazy game reference. You know the JFK game? JFK Reloaded?
No. Is it a game where you're trying to kill JFK?
Yes, it's it is. It's a game, and I've talked about it in a video before. But basically, it's a game that very accurately resets, you know, the kind of like the parade or whatever, where he's in the convertible and you are playing the assassin man, the assassin man.
No, that's what they're called. Yeah, that's the kind of slang that you would hear around that time.
And the point of the game is actually to reinforce, like, it's not a conspiracy focused game, I don't think, but it is kind of like it will show you the exact trajectory that you're shooting at and whatever. And it is just like this specific series of events was like unbelievably unlikely, you know, that you, even if you are trying to perfectly recreate it, you kind of can't. That, like, you know, here's a simulation, you can run it over and over again, you are not going to get exactly the same outcome as what happened there. And I feel like this being like, you're just giving people fortunes, and maybe you are aiming, you know, maybe you are politically motivated and you want Caesar to get assassinated and you're trying to do that. But then, like, it's so hard to actually affect people's behavior in the way that you want to, that, like, most of the endings are just, like, you know, Brutus chickens out, or, like, Caesar gets sick and he doesn't go, or, like, you know, any number of things.
Here's my pitch. So it's the initial game is one screen, and it is the moment before we know, in the modern times, of Julius Caesar about to be stabbed like 40 times. It is one screen, and you are, this is your motivation. Everybody wants Julius Caesar to die. This is, we're making the game for Tumblr. This is a Tumblr Ides of March simulator. And the best case scenario, the goal that you are trying to do to win is kill Julius Caesar. There's like 60 people here. Each one of them has met with the fortune teller in the past before this moment in the game. You have to go through and click on every single one, or some of them. We don't have to do all 60. That's a lot. But maybe there's like 15 key players that you click on. You find their profile, you click on them, and it takes you to another screen where you were in the past doing a fortune telling for them. And the results of the fortune telling that you give them are going to change their behavior in this final scene. So the playthrough is, you're like, you'll click on all of these people, including Julie and including Brutus, and you'll give them their fortune, and if you can give them all the right fortunes to get everything into place, then you'll click go and you'll see, and if you did a good job, they'll kill Caesar. And if not, it'll be one of these alternate options, and then you'll play again.
Yeah, you could. I think that a big appeal of this could be the, like, 30 outcomes that are not exactly killing Caesar. Where...
the 30 joke outcomes.
Yeah, where... I mean, you like Stanley Parable it, where it's like, okay, yes, there's the ending that is correct, yes, but also boring. And then here are like all of the other ones where it's like, you know, and yeah, in some of them, like Brutus and Caesar fall in love. And
my God. Yeah, in one of them, Julius sends somebody else in his stead, sends his wife to go be like, hey, Julius is sick, he's not coming. But they end up stabbing her on accident.
Yeah, or Julius is like, he shows up and everyone's ready to kill him, and he's like, I've been so bad. Like, I have not been doing this well. You guys are right.
Such a tyrant. Oh my God. Yes. All right. This is the idea. I love this. Yeah. What would the fortune telling sections look like? Is it because it's like, if you're in the ancient times, it can be pretty much anything. It could be entrails. If we're doing sloppy, it could be like coins or cards or sticks or, I don't know, boogers. It can be just like whatever you want. A bunch of olive pits.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a chance for gameplay variety would be having a number of these. Because, like, entrails is great, but you don't want to do entrails 15 times. And so, you know, like, maybe it's that sometimes, and sometimes you are doing tea leaves or
What if it's like, what if it is like a structural system? Because like if Julius Caesar comes in to you to get his fortune read, you're slaughtering a goat for that man for sure.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, isn't Julius Caesar? You're going to slaughter a goat to use that entrails for 100%. But if it's like one of the lower level senators, it's like, well.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're going to like throw six different colored rocks and like whatever rock lands up, you know, that'll be your fortune.
Yeah, yeah. Cough into this napkin and I'm going to read the whatever sputum comes up from that. Like, I think that in itself can be part of like the gameplay where he's like, you're trying to parse who all these characters are in a certain extent. And the gameplay, the fortune telling gameplay that you give a certain person is going to help you understand as the player who they are in this, what their ranking is in this, how important they are.
I think that's good because it's like, you know, to tell you the truth, I know who like two of the characters in this are and like
Caesar
no
and
one else. And so it's like, you know, if this, it is, I think that like historical games often actually meld really well with kind of funny writing because it's like most times like history is kind of goofy, you know, and it's like of the nine facts that have remained about these people, you know, over the past 2000 years or whatever, probably four of them are going to be completely absurd. And so like having that in, it's like, well, one of the things that we know about this guy is that he you know, got divorced 12 times or something. It's like, okay, that's funny. We can use that. I don't know how common divorce was as a concept, but
it varied so dramatically based on culture back then. So, but I think that's a really good core that we can pull on. I do think like, how are we getting the player to make the choices about it? Because I do think it's essentially funny if they like, have a bunch of cards on the table and the player is looking at it and is like, I actually don't know how to interpret these. So they do just have to make it up based on what they see. But are they getting like words based on those? Are they getting images? How are they piecing together the fortune they're telling?
This is the gameplay sloppiness where it's like, I feel like in some, you know, the coolest version of this idea is a lot of flexibility, you know, in terms of like being able to just kind of craft almost any sentence out of the entrails that you're looking at. But like that gets really complicated really fast, not only in just like how do you make that sentence, but then like what does the character that you're talking to do with it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we might have to do like an Oberdin style where you have a really limited selection of words and a limited selection of word bubbles where you can drop those words into. I don't hate that.
Yeah,
I think,
you know, if you had kind of like, okay, positive, negative reading, you know, where you could just kind of be like, this is going to be an upper or a downer fortune. And then, you know, be able to select like family relationships, work life, you know, friendship, kind of like give general categories, maybe more than like forming the literal, like the words that you were going to tell them.
That's because that's also more ambiguous, but easier, I think, from a gameplay angle where it can be like, okay, I'm going to give you a friend-based reading and it's going to be negative and it's because you didn't, and then you learn later it's because like this person was like, no, Brutus, I'm not going to stab Caesar, that's messed up. And then he gets okay, here's what it should be. It should be the area of a life, because that's very standard in like fortune telling. Like we're going to talk about like your love life. We're going to talk about your work, that sort of thing. So it's your area of life. It's the bad outcome and the good outcome. So we can press them towards like, if you do this, things will be bad. If you do this, things will be good. So we could have like three categories of things. And it's the thing, the area of life, the options for actions, and whether it's a good or a bad outcome.
Yeah, I think that's good, because then the other cool thing that you could do is kind of differentiate the people you are giving fortunes to by like what are they more motivated by? You know, because maybe if someone is I'm thinking about the Donnie Darko fear and love board, you know, where it's like, here are the two poles of emotion, fear and love. But it's like, if they're kind of, if they are more scared of bad things happening, ooh, then they will be more receptive to a fortune that's like, a bad thing is going to happen unless you do this. But if they're very motivated by like, they want to kind of progress or grow or, you know, be positive, then you can say like, good things will happen if you do this. And you have to kind of like read the person to decide if you're going to kind of like scare them into doing something or excite them into doing something.
The carrot or the stick. Okay.
Yeah.
What if that main, that initial gameplay screen that I was describing, which is moments before Caesar is hopefully stabbed, maybe this is like almost like a classic art setup where it's like each character that you're going to click on is there posing with some sort of object. And so that's how you have a clue to what kind of person they are. So like there's one who's like reading a book and it's a book on death and you're like, I know what this motherfucker is afraid of.
This is, no, you could, yeah, you could totally do the Obra Dinn setup for this where yeah. It's like you have a picture of the whole everyone and maybe yep. When you start the game, it is not actually clear like what everyone's role is.
Right.
You know, and so it's like, okay, well, I can go with that guy because he's clearly like the security guard or something, and I understand what that is in any era.
But he's got then, a like, toga and a bulletproof vest on, and that's how
yeah,
you know.
That's right. But then you can kind of find out through your conversations with some of the simpler guys, like what, you know, what that guy reading a scroll actually is, where it's like, is he a politician? No, he's the you know, he's like taking notes for the whole forum or whatever. He's like the court stenographer for this. And that somehow teaches you a little more about like what he'd be motivated by.
Okay, I like that. Cause you know that like if you're going to like a big fortune telling show where somebody is doing like cold reading, like if you're going to go see somebody who claims to speak to the dead and you're in a big show, oftentimes there will be plants in the audience or in the line to get to the theater talking to people and starting sort of like just genuinely asking like, oh, are you hoping to talk to somebody here? And they'll be like, yeah, my dad, Rupert died and I want to talk to Rupert again. And then that person will just tell the person who's giving the performance like, yeah, there's this lady, she's in this row, her dad Rupert died, she wants to tell him this. And then it's like bing bang boom. So uh-huh. We could do a version of that in this game where it's like every time you talk to somebody who's about to get their fortune read, you just like make small talk with them, and that's how you learn about the other player or the other characters you're gonna have to tell fortunes to.
Yeah,
where it's just like, oh man, I hear Brutus is a terrible boss. And he's like, no, Brutus is a great boss. I mean, he does do this one thing that is uh-huh. such and such. Like, I think that would be a really funny angle to investigate everyone.
Yeah, that would be good. Because I think getting into, you know, it's like the personalities of the people that you are reading the fortunes of are going to be really important in making it not just feel like you're doing the same thing 15 times.
They're all the sorts of, well, I guess this is a trick because I was going to say they're all the sorts of person who would go to a fortune teller, which means they're already probably receptive to it. But in ancient Roman times, I don't know if it was relatively more consistent, like if it was just a thing that you would do more often or more credulously.
Yeah, or, you know, I don't know, you get someone coming in and they're like, I think this is bullshit, but my husband is making me go. So
yes. Like, okay, I do love that. I love the idea that you've got the incredulous ones. And you, what if you know, based on a couple playthroughs, that person is just going to do the opposite of whatever you say? Because they're like, yeah. Fuck you. I don't believe in you. And also, I hate you. So I'm not going to do this.
And or you find like the one thing that they're actually, you know, really sensitive about or whatever. And then they just like crack and will do whatever you tell them.
How did you know I was sensitive about the moles on my back? Wow, you really are a good fortune teller, et cetera,
there
et cetera.
There is a magic show that I watched on Hulu, towards the beginning of the pandemic, that was called, I can't remember the guy's name, but it was called In and of Itself. And it was like, it was kind of one of those storytelling shows where he didn't do that many tricks, but they were all related to it. But like the big showstopper at the end, and it was truly unlike anything I've ever seen, is like when everyone in the audience got there before the show started, they were kind of, there's this big board that had just like hundreds of kind of adjectives or just descriptors on them, whereas like, I am a mother, I'm a friend, but also like, I'm a failure, or like, I'm scared, or whatever. And everyone just like takes one of those and they just sit down, and there are like, you know, 70 people in the audience. And then at the end of the show, he just stands on stage and he goes through, seemingly with no props, every single person who is there. He's just like, this is what you picked. This is what you picked. And it's like, people are like breaking down in the crowd, both kind of like hearing someone say like positive and negative things about them that they themselves selected, where like, to even though they picked like, I am, you know, like, I am lonely, hearing him say like, you are lonely, then they like start weeping, and it like,
oh my God,
it could have all been planted, but like, it really didn't seem like it. And maybe it was just because it was like, you know, January of 2021 and I was like, losing my fucking mind, but like, it really got me. And so I feel like there is, you know, the kind of like, I like the idea that like, the surface level of this is, it's all just kind of made up, it's fortune telling, like, that doesn't really exist. But the deeper truth of tarot reading, of any of this, is like, it is about knowing people. And you know, like, I think you could find those emotional moments in like a silly game by just being like, this person is like unexpectedly vulnerable in front of you in a way that they're not otherwise, because they think that you already know everything about them.
I mean, yeah, that's the trick about fortune telling, is that if you're on the outside looking at it, looking at people having their tarot read, or being, you know, cold read in an audience by somebody who says they can speak to the dead, is, if you're standing outside of that, it's really easy to be like, well, that's a trick, that's a trap, they're just trying to pull one over on you. But if you are the one subject to those attentions, it can be very convincing, it can be very powerful. And that's sort of the nice part about fortune telling, is that like, it is that it is kind of an intimate experience of somebody, or getting your palm read, like having just somebody holding your hand and like feathery touching it and talking to you low. It is a very satisfying and pleasing experience. And the dangerous part is when people take that information and are like, I'm going to change my whole life because this fortune teller said that heaven exists and that my parents are there waiting for me. And then like, it's those sorts of things. It's like, when you make too much of what it is where the real danger of fortune telling lies. I love fortune telling, though. I love getting my tarot read, and I do it all the time. But I do think you're right, especially because like, this is kind of, we're making kind of a joke comedy game, but it is a game about murdering your boss. It is a game about like stabbing your god emperor and like the leader of your entire culture. And so I do think there is essentially a tricky core that the closer you get to successfully having everyone stab Caesar, like the more tender and the more raw you have the potential to get with those emotional experiences.
Oh, can I? Okay. I just had, can I suggest like a very specific scene for the game? So, okay. So we've done like 14 of the 15 people. Maybe the last person is Caesar, you know, like it's all been building up to this. And then you have the moment that I like, I don't even know what the trope would be called for this, but it's like the pretender has a moment of actual clarity where it's like, you receive an actual premonition of the future, you know, and it's like, it's like big, and suddenly you kind of know what is going to happen, you know, like if Caesar gets stabbed, you know, you see, maybe you see like the year 2020 or something, but it is almost like, you know, like you've gone so far forward, and it's like, it's so big that it is almost inactionable, you know, like you can't consider how whatever you tell the fortune, like, how is this going to affect the future? I don't know. You know, I don't know in like the butterfly effect, if I step on this butterfly or not, like what is actually going to happen. I just know it's going to change things.
That's not what the butterfly effect is. Do you think it's stepping on butterflies?
Yes. This is the sound. I mean, It is, I know it's the butterfly flaps its wings and it creates a hurricane, but it's like The Sound of Thunder, the Ray Bradbury story, is literally someone steps on a butterfly. And like, that's, I think that's one of the earliest versions of that trope being used.
Are you imagining this harrowing moment of the pretender made real as being like happening before? Because like, from a gameplay standpoint, I think there is something really useful about being like, having that be a moment where the player gets information about where they have succeeded and failed. Because that's the other tricky thing, is like, obviously this is going to have to be a game of experimentation where you just fuck around with fortunes,
yeah,
and see what works. But it would be nice to have something there guiding them. So we could do something like that, where it's like a guiding mechanic of the word of Apollo coming down and being like, you fucked this part up.
Uh-huh.
I guess it wouldn't be Apollo, it would be the Roman. I don't know who the Roman god Apollo equivalent is, but you could do that from a gameplay standpoint. But it sounds like you're talking about more of a games as art kind of reckoning, emotional reckoning moment.
Yeah, I am thinking like end of Metal Gear Solid 2, you know, like suddenly it's just like you're in the real world and this is happening. But it's, yeah, it's hard because it's like basically the idea that I'm envisioning would make it very hard for your choices prior to that to matter, because it would basically be like your one big decision is, do you want this future to come to pass or not? So maybe here's the thing. Maybe it only happens if you have actually ticked every other box for people to kill Caesar. Ooh. You know, it's like, so you've actually gone through the game a couple times. You've got a bunch of like comedic outcomes. You're like, haha, I know what this is. And then suddenly you're on the right path. You like, you feel like they're finally gonna do it. They're gonna stab him. And yeah, then you receive this moment of like actual clairvoyance.
Hmm. Okay. And then that could also, from a gameplay standpoint, maybe it's an option to choose which ending you want to be the correct one. So like, we know the right one, which is where Caesar gets stabbed right and dies.
No, it's almost, it is almost like, it's suddenly an acknowledgement of the artifice, like of the player, you know, because it's like the only way to get to this point is for you to have done it a whole bunch of times, which is impossible unless you're playing a game, you know. And so it's like, it suddenly your ability to see the future is like an acknowledgement that it's like, yeah, we know you're not this fortune teller. You're someone sitting at a computer in the year 2024. And like, that's how you're able to do all this stuff. Now, let me ask you, are you happy? Do you want to make this future happen again?
But there's no right answer to that, Jacob. You know that, right?
I know.
I do like that, because like the conceit around roguelikes and time loops is that like roguelikes or all video games are sort of time loops because you're going back to the beginning and replaying it. But we're like, no, all video games are fortune telling.
Yeah.
And you're going back, you're having this vision of a possible future, and then you're going back and choosing a different future because game loops are about fortune telling.
I mean, it is really, it's like the knowledge that there is a good ending or like a true ending to a game is like you kind of knowing the future and trying to take steps to achieve it. Like, yeah, that's, you know, if you didn't know there was a good ending, you might not like work as hard to like, you know, get everyone's bond level up enough that they all like rescue you at the end or whatever. But like, because you know that, because you know how game stories work, then you're motivated to do that. And so I feel like it is this cool mending of the text and the meta text into one.
It's funny you say that, because I almost never do. In fact, I genuinely try not to look up whether or not there are multiple endings or true endings. Like that it's borderline spoiler territory to me, because I'm never going to put in the effort to come up with a specific ending. Uh-huh. I'm always more curious to play how I play and see what the game has to say about that. So that is not how I approach games. I'm, and just I like, I don't know, I'll get the ending I get.
That is often more like, it's a more interesting experience, you know. Like if I was playing Disco Elysium trying to get the good ending, it's like, well, that's boring, because like the whole game is about like messing up or whatever. And so it's kind of like playing the game instead of living or having your own experience or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's just a different gameplay approach. And it's funny you mentioned Disco Elysium, because I do believe in my playthrough, once I learned there was like a supernatural option towards the end, I was like, mm-hmm. well, we have to get that, unfortunately. So, but everything else was pretty much just like, I don't know, you live your life and you take what happens. And yeah, that's my video game fantasy. It's not having a good ending. It's living a good life and accepting the ending you've got.
Wow. What a fantasy.
What are we naming this game, which I'm really into?
I mean, should it be some kind of Ides of March pun? That does seem like that's probably the hook of the game.
It's a fortune-telling Julius Caesar murder sim, so I think calling attention to that would be a good idea. What are some good... I mean, of March probably has to stay the same. It probably has to be something with Ides, right? Maybe you do a lot of sea-based fortune-telling and it's the Tides of March.
Yeah, you're on a boat. We haven't mentioned that up to this point. But...
you're on the Mediterranean. You're doing a lot of seashell-based fortune-telling, maybe? Yeah.
You know,
if
this
we
is
wanted
actually,
to retroactively push it.
This is not too dissimilar from, like, a Slay the Princess concept. That we've created a whole, like, branching timelines thing that kind of aims towards, you gotta kill this person at some point.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think, yeah, it's like, can you try to fit, like, violence into the title, you know, something implying that you're gonna be like trying to kill Caesar, or is of March doing enough work there?
Well, that's tricky, because if we get too far away from the phrase Ides of March, I do feel like we're creating a situation in which it is no longer clear what we're doing. But we could also do something really splashy with a title like Caesar Must Die.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of the Slay the Princess figure. Like,
I'm on Rhyme Zone looking
for
Ides. Yeah.
For Ides rhymes, what do you got? Hit me.
Oh boy. Well, you know, these get like bananas immediately. So it's like, okay, we have guides. Wait.
Guides of March.
That's gotta,
guides,
I mean, it's
of
like
March. Okay.
Fortune Guides of March.
Well, that's, I don't know about Fortune
Guide. Yeah, no
guides
one says Fortune Guide.
I mean, Guides of March is pretty good, actually. It's not, I don't know if it's the best, but I think it's pretty good.
Yeah. It definitely, like, it's all, the only thing that it doesn't have is, like, pizzazz. You know, it's like, okay, it's got relevance, it does relate to the game that we're playing, but it's like, I don't think anyone's going to see Guides of March on like the Steam newly uploaded and be like, gotta check that out.
Yeah, it's tricky because it's clever, but it's not good.
what a problem to run into.
Are there any other good rhymes?
You know, you could play into the multiple timelines or possibilities things with like sides. You could do like the Thousand Sides of March. Which is completely incomprehensible, but as the person who made the game, I'd be like, oh, pretty cool.
I don't know if we're going to find an Ides option. I don't hate Guides of March.
Guides of March is pretty good. And then we just, you know, really invest in the art for the game. And so that's what catches people's eyes.
Yeah. We're doing the Indica strategy, which is the title is like, what even is that? But then the key art is so good. People will be like, all right, I'll give it a try. Yeah. The only other option is we could do something with Julius Caesar, something around his name, like 40 stabs for 40 Caesars.
What about like fortune favors the Caesar?
I mean, that's a good ironic title because it really doesn't in our game.
Fortune parentheses doesn't favor the Caesar.
Really, really laborious in so many ways.
That you could do, you know, it's like if you didn't want it to be punny, it could be like the many deaths of Julius Caesar or something. But that doesn't really, it doesn't give like the fortune telling angle, which I do feel like you want to tell people why it's cool.
We could do like intestines for Caesar.
And that's like, that's good. I think that's pretty good.
Does it communicate anything about really anything. Intestines for Caesar? I mean, it is catchy. It's eye-catchy. If somebody said that title to me, I'd be like, okay, that's sticking with me.
Yeah, you can kind of start to see what the logo would look like. It's gross.
Yeah, it's sloppy. It's a pile of steaming intestines, and it reads out intestines for Caesar.
I like that. I think that's good.
Okay, and then the tagline can be Guides of March. All right, intestines for Caesar. I actually like that. Okay, I like intestines for Caesar. It's gross.
It's gross, but I think, yeah, it's like that's... especially for people who maybe aren't sold on just fortune telling as a cool thing.
Yeah.
The idea that it's like gross fortune telling is fun. You know, that'll get them.
Jacob, do you have anything to plug?
I do. I'm making a book. We announced this just a couple weeks ago. The basic thing to plug is I have a YouTube channel called Jacob Geller where I write essays and make videos out of them. But the book, which is called How a Game Lives, is my favorite essays that I've written over my YouTube career, annotated by me, where I just go back and write all sorts of notes on kind of the creation of the essay and stuff that I couldn't fit in and all sorts of stuff like that. And then there are a bunch of other authors who are coming in and writing afterwards for all of those essays. And there's a bunch of original art for the book. And it's very exciting. And I think if you like the stuff that I've done in the past, and especially if you like kind of thinking about the writing process or getting to peek behind the scenes, you will be into this. You can buy it from Lost in Cult's website, lostincult.co.uk, I think. If you just go to my Twitter, it's like the pinned tweet. You'll see it.
Yeah, and I'll put a link in the description, the show notes description of this episode, so you can find it. It'll just be there, and it'll be easy for you to click and go to. But it's, yeah, lostincult.co.uk, so it's a double. Big Game Hunger is a part of the Multitude Collective of podcasts, created and hosted by me, Jenna Stever. If you enjoy this episode, don't forget to subscribe and spread the word so other people can enjoy it as well. To support the show directly, subscribe at patreon.com/thejenna. Every month, subscribers can submit prompts that get added to the ingredient list like the Ides of March, which was submitted by Longtone. Thank you, Longtone. Help guide the podcast and our brainstorming at patreon.com/thejenna. Jacob, what's one word, adjective, gameplay type, premise, etc. that you would like to add to the ingredient list?
Kick punch.
to which header? Premise? Adjective? Gameplay type?
Gameplay type.
Okay. Kick punch. That just made me think of Rock'em Sock'em Robots, a thing I have not thought about in a long time.
More people need to make video games out of Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
When are we going to get a video game adaptation of Rock'em Sock'em? And then when are we going to get a movie adaptation of the video game adaptation of Rock'em Sock'em Robots?
Probably the movie will happen first. That'll happen in like 2026. When all of the Barbie takeoffs are coming out and bombing. Uno movie, Monopoly movie, Rock'em Sock'em Robots movie.
What a miserable year that's going to be for us. Thank you for joining me today, Jacob.
It was my genuine pleasure.
Yay. Thank you, listener, for enjoying Big Game Hunger. And don't forget to wishlist Intestines for Caesar on Steam. Release date, TBD.